I like a bed that's really firm.
I need something a little softer than that.
Rest easy. With the Sleep Number 360 Smart Bed, you can both adjust your comfort with your sleep number setting.
Can it really help me fall asleep faster?
Yes, by gently warming your feet.
Okay, but can it help keep us asleep?
It senses your movements and automatically adjusts to keep you effortlessly comfortable. Sleep Number, proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep. It's our biggest sale of the year where all beds are on sale. Save 50% on the Sleep Number 360 Limited Edition Smart Bed. Only for a limited time. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.
Sarah, you've got quite a story, which I'm really looking forward to hearing you speak about. You are what is called, and I've never actually met anyone who does this before, so you're quite unique. You're a life reclamation expert and a coach for widows. Is that quite a unique space to be in?
It's pretty unique. Typically, you hear about pastors, preachers, and therapists doing this work. And so I'm in a niche here where we're talking about coaching and looking forward instead of spending a lot of time looking back.
You call yourself a reclamation. I hope I said it right. My Australian accent can tend to skew things. A life reclamation expert. Obviously, with loss, you know, when human beings experience it in varying degrees, sometimes it may not be death or, someone leaves their body and moves on. It can be to the point of some people lose a relationship or they lose a friendship because there's a disconnection. Tell me a little bit about how you kind of found yourself serving people this way.
I stepped into this work after having a really personal encounter with a need for this work, because in 2014, I actually became a widow and I was looking for something in the grief support world that felt like empowerment and inspiration and hope, and really helped me come home to myself in a new way. Because a lot of the support was really about survival skills and coping strategies and stress management. And I didn't see myself or my life forward in any of that. It was just sort of teaching me how to kind of be here in this space of surviving, which I felt like was teaching me how to settle in a lifetime of grief. And so I went on this big journey attempting to reclaim myself in some connection with the story of what came next in my life after loss. And essentially, as I found hope and transformation in my own story, I realized I had to look so hard for this, which means everybody else is probably doing the same thing, and decided that this was the work that I was going to do, was spend the rest of my life spreading this message of what's possible in life after loss if we're willing to take that journey.
What did you find possible for you? Because obviously to get to that space when you, I think losing someone when it's also, you know, when you have that layer of shock, because it obviously wasn't something that you were expecting. It was an unexpected death that happened, and especially to your husband. What did you have to go through? What were the reactions from people like when you experienced this loss and, you know, you were obviously grieving through it? What did you have to kind of, what was it like for you going through that?
I love that you asked this question. It's interesting because everyone was really, really desperate to love me and to take care of me, which was wonderful, except it came through as pity, which was really, really devastating to my sense of self, and certainly made any semblance of hope that I kind of had the audacity to cling to for a better someday really seem kind of ridiculous. So when you ask that question, what was it like? It was really interesting, and it seems to be more and more universal the more women I support in this work. We're really clinging to this really bizarre place where we have to believe in something nobody around us can believe in. Nobody around us is willing to believe in. And in fact, we also have to be really willing to endure a lot of projected guilt, shame, and fear of judgment to move in that direction. So I'm actually referring to myself now as the renegade widow, because I've realized the most renegade decision I ever made was to choose living and to choose joy. And it was really confusing for the people around me to watch me do that.
There seems to be, and I've kind of experienced this coming from an Eastern culture, there seems to be, I don't know what other experiences you've had with this, Sarah, or if you can relate, but when there is a loss in life, or there's a somewhat sudden shock that happens, and there's an expectation that you are to be a certain way and not be happy for a period of time. I think I worded that really poorly and perhaps harshly, but I find that, you know, you're smiling. It's not really appropriate for you to do that, but why not?
You know, I think we're still stuck in this strange, archaic definition of grief. You know, long ago when it was much more of a religious experience, I think there were you know, there were rules around it, actual rules about how many days you had to wear black and, you know, the different things that you had to do as sort of like the requisite mourning for the outside observers to watch you move through. And so I think that there's still a lot of remnants of that built into our collective consciousness about what's appropriate and what's right and what's real for us. And because we live in a world now that masquerades this really deep connection with social media, but also comes with a really real disconnect in reality, it creates this confusion. So on the outside, we often look amazing. And people are so willing to say that. You look amazing. You're so strong. You're inspiring. You're doing great. And that's taking a lot of work and effort on your part to project that. But on the inside, it's a different story entirely, where you feel totally unseen, totally unhinged, and, you know, awful. It doesn't feel strong. It doesn't feel inspiring on the inside. And so it's a real problem when society around us is sort of measuring our okayness by those old ancient standards of you're doing great, you're showing up, you're feeding your kids, you're paying your bills, you must be fine. And seeing posts on social media about how fine we are, but also leaving us to do the gnarly work of grieving alone in our closet in the darkness at midnight. And I think that's really created a problem, a confusion about what grief even is.
When you decided to make this, you're obviously a coach now about this, and you've got a podcast about grief and sharing wisdom about overcoming grief and reclaiming your life. When you started pursuing that path, what was that like for you? What was the, I guess, resistance that you felt from people?
Honestly, the resistance was from myself most of all, because I was terrified to have this really opinionated message that differed greatly from the norm. I was talking about, and I am talking about, something that other people don't think is real, other people don't think is possible. And at the same time, I was really encouraged by the fact that anyone who had lost someone they loved, anyone who was grieving, when they heard my message, when they heard me speak, they said, yes, thank you. This is the thing I've been looking for and waiting for. And this is the conversation that I'm positive we need to be having more in our culture around grief and life after loss and what's possible.
Having this conversation around grief, it's probably a very difficult conversation to have, especially because you're going through something that, and mourning a person who, you know, is not going to return in this lifetime. That's quite a tough topic to coach people through.
It is and it isn't, because quickly we see something bigger than the death of the person we loved being revealed. And there's a couple pieces of it. So on the one hand, people are terrified that they have to forget that person and that love story to heal. And I love being able to invite them to soften into the knowing that, A, they're never going to forget it, and B, they don't have to step into a life of joy and purpose and maybe even love again. So giving people permission to just not have to worry about choosing to remember the past or be in the present. But the other thing that is revealed really quickly in our conversations is that a lot of the fear, the pain that we're experiencing is both unexpressed grief, because we don't really live in a culture that gives us tools to do anything with what we're feeling. And it's also this unexpressed sense of self, because when someone we love dies, or we lose something that really is inherent to our identity, our existence in the world, it's as though our existence is kind of challenged at all. Like, who am I now without this person, without this role of mother or wife, or, you know, whatever that has been lost tied to that identity. And so that's a really cool place where we get to find some connection to who am I beyond that love story that's ended too soon. And what's interesting is it steps us out of this grief world almost into this self-discovery space. And that's where it becomes really powerful and really fun.
Sarah, you talk about the layers of grief, and there's many layers that I guess everyone goes through to get to the other side where they reclaim their life, which I'm assuming that is the pot at the end of the rainbow. Can you talk us through some of those layers and, in your experience, what it's been to get to the other side of that?
You know, I think the first important layer is really creating stillness in our life. we live in a culture, again, that really teaches us to work hard, to stay strong, keep calm, carry on, all these lovely adages that they teach us. And they also talk about time healing all. And yet the grief support world sort of points us in the direction of find a routine, keep busy, exercise, do things that you love. And so I find these people, myself included at the time, were working really hard to try and get our grief right, to do the right things. And it's really about keeping us healthy because we've made grief into pathology. We've made grief into a thing to avoid. And so what I invite people to do when they're in this space of grieving is first, let's reevaluate your life. Let's reevaluate your day and your energy output. Because what we find is we're extra exhausted inside the space of grief because our physiology, our body is sort of stuck in survival mode. And that creates a whole new state of being in the way our hormones operate, the way our circulation operates. Everything in our physical body is impacted by the grief, not just our heart and our head. And when we move through our days with this hyper active, really intense way of being, this busyness, if you will, it keeps our body stuck there. And so when we create some stillness in our life intentionally, not only does it allow our physical body to come back to a more natural state of being, it also gives us then space to do this really important head and heart work of acknowledging our grief, expressing our grief, and learning from it so we can step into what comes next with our eyes more open.
It's interesting the paradox that you've talked about, the connection between, you know, what we're so accustomed to doing as humans and being on autopilot, throwing ourselves into our busy schedules and what seems so natural to us where the body kind of, you know, still stays in that place of grief. That's quite a powerful paradox that you've highlighted there, Sarah. When it comes to the other layer of grief, what is that other layer is the first question. And secondly, what are some of the consequences if you don't address that?
So another layer of grief is mindfulness, is the simple way to explain it. But that's a word that's really hard for people to hear. It's like, great, what's mindfulness? How do we do that? And so I like to break it down into simpler terms over brunch of, can you notice what you notice about what you need or don't need, what you want or don't want, what you're feeling or not feeling? Because so often there's this heightened sense of awareness around what we think we should be needing and wanting, or what we or other people think we should be needing and feeling. And when we're able to sort of eliminate that filtration system from our thought process and get more connected to what's actually true for us, we can start paying attention to ourselves in a bigger way. And once we have that awareness, then we can start choosing differently. We can start communicating differently. We can start receiving differently and creating boundaries and having courageous conversations where we need them. And so that's the part that the life reclamation really comes into play is, as you said earlier, sleepwalking through our days. There's so much of that in our world anymore with this hyper busyness, this hyper connection. Everybody's always on and present, you know, on show, on stage with everybody else. And so inside this grief landscape, can we just slow down enough that there's space now to notice ourselves, notice our thoughts, our needs, and then communicate them or do something with them as a form of life reclamation. And the second part of your question, what happens if we don't, is it's sort of what's become acknowledged as the normal model of grief. This is what everybody thinks grief is, which is grief lasts forever. And so people expect and anticipate and sort of give in to this notion that they're always going to be aching. They're always going to be in pain. Their life will always sort of be this scraped together second best kind of thing because of what was lost. And it's really unfortunate that that has become so normalized, not just in, you know, the grief support world, but also even in the media and the popular culture where it's become akin to truth and people believe it so much that they don't actually even consider grief support. They don't actually even consider taking this journey into grief and understanding what they're feeling and moving with it and moving through it. And I think that's a really huge consequence of not paying attention. and watching so many others have this same experience of, life was never the same after that. So I like to talk about this idea that grief leaves us forever changed, but doesn't have to mean forever suffering.
You touched on there how people tend to, when they dive into their schedules and they're on autopilot or sleepwalking through life, it was what you said. And, you know, it seems from what you've just explained about humans and how we process grief is we tend to avoid it. And we tend to not want to have those courageous conversations about it. It's something that I guess it's a human condition and the human behavior where when something is good for us to work through and it can be gut-wrenching at the time, at the end of it, there is this, like you said, reclamation.
Absolutely. I think it is a human condition, but it's also this, like I said, sort of out-of-dated thought, belief system, maybe even that grief is this taboo topic that should not be seen, should not be expressed. I think it comes from religion. I think it comes from a different period of time where there was shame attached to emotions. There was shame attached to grief, that it would bring shame to the family if people saw this tragic widow wailing in the streets. So keep it hidden, keep it tidy, keep it put away. And it's still pervasive somehow in our thought process because we've never had these brave radical conversations about what's it like to grieve? How do we grieve? What can we do? What is normal for grief? Even still in the modern day, we really treat it akin to mental illness. We think it's one bad day away from depression or worse. And that keeps us, I think, away from even wanting to do anything at all. I will avoid it at all costs. I will work endlessly and tirelessly to pretend it away. I will out-hustle it and I will do my best to outlast this horrible thing, with hopes that someday me and everyone around me will believe that it's actually true.
You said earlier that one of the biggest obstacles you faced was yourself. Do you mind expanding upon that statement?
Oh, absolutely. I spent probably the first year of my grief journey after my husband died trapped in this state of constant fear. And what I was trying to do was get my grief right. I had decided there was a good way and a bad way, a right and wrong way to grieve. And I had really put the power in everyone else's hands around what that meant. So I would often use the proverbial they to talk about the dilemma that I would face. For example, I was trying to decide whether or not to keep my wedding ring on. And the conversation would go something like, well, they will say that, you know, I'm a hussy and I'm out looking for a new husband and a new father for my children if I take my wedding ring off too soon. But if I leave it on too long, they will say, right, what a pathetic thing. How sad that she can't get over it. She's missing out. She should be moving on. And so every single decision, I really measured between these two options. They both could be right and they both could be wrong. And I found myself often stuck in, what happens if I choose this? What will they say? What will they make that mean? What will they do about? I was really afraid of being abandoned, of being rejected, of being condemned for being a bad widow. I had tied so much of my sense of self now to being a good widow, since I couldn't be a good wife, as a representation of my love story. And so the reason I was my own worst enemy in all of that became very apparent to me when my best friend asked me one day while lamenting to her over the phone, has anybody ever actually said these horrible things to you? And I paused and kind of giggled and realized, no, actually, there may have been a few passive-aggressive attempts at weighing me one way or the other in some of my choices, but ultimately, in most cases, this was all imagined in my head. No one had actually said these things to me, and I was making myself physically sick and incapacitated to make decisions because I was so worried about what other people might say. They hadn't actually said it. So when I was able to finally weigh every decision against this one standard, it got easier. I would simply say, what feels most true for me right now? And that would be the choice that I would make, with the one caveat that I always reserved the right to change my mind later and not make it mean that I was wrong before, but that I had evolved and had more information now.
Sarah, something that you've touched on there was that, you know, you were your own kind of most critical judge throughout the process, and you thought people were saying things that, you know, led you to be unkind to yourself. I guess something that I've learned having this conversation with you is grief is kind of the timeline to grief. There is no such thing as a timeline. It's very personal. And the journey is as it is and however long you need it to be. If you could give any advice to anyone or any wisdom that you want to impart to anyone who's going through grief and they kind of don't see themselves getting out of it, what would it be?
I think the best thing I could invite anyone who's grieving to do is to seek support where they feel seen and nurtured. Because often we seek support for someone to fix us or save us from it. Our families want to do that. Our friends want to do that. And even, you know, sometimes professionals feel like their work, their job, their role in our grief is to save us from it or to fix it for us. And what I've found is most important actually in having a profound grief experience is being with people. Maybe it's just one person, maybe it's just a few people who can have this really gentle, non-invasive presence in your life where they can be with you in it and they can see you in it. And when there's days that you need to laugh, they'll laugh. And when there's days that they need to cry, they'll cry. And sometimes they'll realize that both of those days happen at the same time and you'll be laughing while you're crying. And so what I've really worked on creating is this environment in my community where solidarity and sisterhood is the very first and most important foundation that we've built everything around. Can you be in this space and be unconditionally loved and seen and honored where you are without comparison, without needing to be fixed? The journey that comes next comes from this idea that we can be vulnerable and that we can be real and that we don't have to be fixed, but that we're here to actually learn how to experience this in the first place.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time today and for explaining grief in such an empowering and beautiful way that hasn't been explained to me before. It's been so cozy and calming. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed this opportunity to have this conversation.
It's time to party. The Genie Show.
Hi, this is Brooke Devard from Naked Beauty. Are you tired of feeling housebound? I sure am. Break free with the new Unbound Cordless Auto Curler from Conair. It's a high-performance auto curler that's rechargeable and gives you up to 60 minutes of cord-free runtime. Just think of all of the incredible hair looks you can create in 60 minutes unbound away from your wall. Don't get tied down by cords. Love your look, live unbound. Check it out at conair.com and search unbound.